Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Sunday, February 24, 2019. Welcome back to the Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting and leaky black. Matt Norlander is here with me, and there were a bunch of impressive performances this weekend. Duke won at Syracuse by double digits without Zion. Virginia won at Louisville by double digits while holding the Cardinals to 15 second-half points. Kentucky blasted Auburn by 27 points at Rupp Arena. LSU beat Tennessee, even though Tremont Waters did not play. North Carolina snapped Florida State's 8-game winning streak with an 18-point win over the Seminoles. Michigan State went into Michigan shorthanded and won. We're going to get to some of that, probably most of that, at some point in this podcast. But I wanted to start with the most impressive performance of the weekend from a point spread perspective in a nationally relevant game, and that was Texas Tech's 91-62 beatdown of Kansas. Texas Tech was a 4.5-point favorite, won by 29, so they covered by 24.5 points, and now Bill Self's Jayhawks are 2 games back at Kansas State and 1 game back at Texas Tech in the Big 12 standings. They're tied for third with 4 regular season games left. Norlander, 2 questions. How awesome was Texas Tech Saturday night, and are you finally ready to write a eulogy for KU's streak of Big 12 titles? Because it's a it's probably about to die.
I am so sick of the Kansas question, but you know what? This is what you get if you're Kansas and you win 14 in a row. This question's just going to get thrown out there. I'm not ready. I will be ready finally if Kansas does not win at home Monday night against Kansas State. That is a huge game, the biggest game of Monday. K-State's got to go on the road there. And remember, Kansas lost against K-State back earlier this month, in a relatively decent game there. So that's a big one. And then they're on the road against Oklahoma State and Oklahoma, both winnable for Kansas, even with the shorthanded roster. And then they get Baylor at home to finish. I think it's completely plausible, maybe not more likely than not, but it is plausible that Kansas does not lose a league game again, finishes with 5 losses overall, and 5 losses to me is going to put you at the top of the standings in this conference, probably sharing it with at least one more team, but that's where I stand. If KU loses on Monday night, then I'm done. Then it's over. They're going to have a 3-game deficit in the loss column. We'll not be able to make that up, but I will stick with that for now. As for Texas Tech, extremely impressive. They are the inverse of Villanova. Villanova was bad early, really good in the middle, and now have lost 4 of 5, and the Wildcats are a complete mystery, like the least trustworthy top 30-ish team, if you even want to define them that, in the country. Whereas Texas Tech started well, dropped a more competitive game than the final score indicates, and back to Duke right before Christmas. I can't believe that it's been more than 2 months since that game was played. This season is zipping by. Then they take the lull, like Michigan State, who we'll get to in a little bit. They drop 3 in a row, lose a game in horrible fashion at Kansas earlier this month. And since then, it's been back to the winning ways. 50, 54, 50, 61, 62. Those are the opponent totals against Texas Tech, which has reclaimed its spot as the best defense in America. What it did to Kansas was a complete ass-kicking. That was extremely, extremely impressive. And now Texas Tech's schedule wraps up like this in the regular season. Home to Oklahoma State, that's a W. That's a win. At TCU, that's a loss. Home to Texas, that's a win. At Iowa State, I don't know. Iowa State's not trustworthy all that well either, but Texas Tech is back in fine form, and whereas this team made the Elite Eight last season, I have belief that it can get back there. Not saying I'm going to pick them to do that, but man, they are really coming together and gelling really well. Matt Mooney, the South Dakota grad transfer, is now shooting 40% from three. They've got other guys who can shoot it from deep, and when you've got that plus the defense, very, very impressive. And a little bit, I don't want to say Parrish, it was lost over the weekend, but with all, like, you know, the Duke hype and all this stuff and some other notable games, it felt maybe like the Texas Tech stuff might have just breezed past some folks. So I'm glad we opened with that.
To your point about Monday night's game between Kansas and Kansas State being huge, you can't overstate how big it is because, as you noted, if Kansas loses that game, it's basically game, set, match, because Kansas State would then have a 3-game lead over Kansas with just 3 games left to play, which would mean any additional Kansas State win or Kansas loss would end it officially. And 2 of KSU's final 3 games are home games against unranked Baylor and unranked Oklahoma. Both Baylor and Oklahoma are sub-30 KenPom teams, and for whatever it's worth, Kansas State has not lost at home to a sub-30 KenPom team all season. So it seems unlikely they do it twice in the final 8 days of the regular season, right? So I do think if Kansas State goes into Allen Fieldhouse and wins, that's it. Even if Kansas wins Monday night, though, I'll bottom line it this way. I think the only chance they got to even share it at this point is to win out, because that would keep them at five losses, but they would still need Texas Tech to lose somewhere. And you went through that schedule. I don't know that they're going to lose anywhere. They sure as hell won't lose if they keep playing the way they've been playing. They've won five straight Big 12 games by an average of 25 points, and that includes the beatdown of Kansas. So it's not guaranteed that Texas Tech's going to even take a fifth league loss, but I sure as hell don't think they're going to get to six league losses. So Kansas has got to win out, and it is, from a probabilities perspective, it's unlikely they're going to do.
Unlikely, but Iowa State's good enough to do it. They're just an enigma. They've been an underachieving team as of late, have the Cyclones. So we'll see on that. But the Big 12, hey, we've got some real uncertainty, true uncertainty down the stretch here. We'll wait and see.
So Duke won at Syracuse without Zion Williamson on Saturday night. We're going to get into that next. But first, check this out.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
So Duke won 75-65 at Syracuse on Saturday night in front of a record-setting crowd. Zion Williamson did not play, and neither Trey Jones nor Cam Reddish played well, but R.J. Barrett was awesome. Took 20 shots, made 14, finished with 30 points, 7 assists, 5 rebounds, led the team in points and assists. And more than anything, and I sort of wrote about this at CBSSports.com, it was a reminder, this game. Maybe we didn't need a reminder, but it served as a reminder that even when Zion Williamson is out, Duke still has the best player on the floor every game it plays, no matter who it plays. His name's R.J. Barrett. I mean, he's going to be a first-team All-American, should be, right there with Zion Williamson. Would you agree with that?
I would not agree with that right at this moment, Parrish. I'm not putting it out of hand. I think it is possible. But there's a lot of good dudes out there. I actually think that the first-team All-America race is developing into something that's really fun. You're right in that any game that Duke plays, if Zion's not on the floor, then RJ is the most talented dude, almost definitely. But given what Gonzaga's doing, I think Brandon Clark's going to be in the mix there. If Texas Tech wins the Big 12, Jarrett Culver's going to compete for that. Grant Williams or P.J. Washington, if one of those teams get a one seed, Marcus Howard is in the mix. I don't think that Ja Morant is a sure thing, but GP, if he averages 20 and 10, he'll be the first player ever to do that. So he's going to clearly be in the mix there as well. And so it's a matter of those guys. And, hey, like Cassius Winston, with what he did today, if Michigan State doesn't lose again, he's there. So it's a matter of, like, do not that Zion and RJ would cancel each other out, but is RJ going to be bumping up against other players? And then it's the voting contingent that would be willing to say, I'm going to put two Duke guys on the team as opposed to having one guy from different teams.
For what it's worth, at the KenPom Player of the Year ratings, Zion Williamson is number one. Ethan Happ is number two. RJ Barrett is number three. So there's two Duke players in the top three there. If you're curious, the rest of the top 10, Jarrett Culver, Carson Edwards, Brandon Clark, Cassius Winston, Rui Hachimura, Grant Williams, and Marcus Howard. As always, we'll see. But I think if I had to turn in a ballot for first-team All-Americans today, it would have both Zion Williamson and RJ Barrett on it. Trivia time! When was the last time one team had two first-team AP All-Americans?
This is first of all, I'm proud of you because you know what? That is not only relevant to the discussion, that is a great question. And I would also note, Parrish, if we had to file right now, I would put Zion and RJ on my first team, but I want to see how the rest of the season plays out. What he did against Syracuse was awesome. The last team to have two first-team All-Americans. Okay, first question is this. Has it happened within the past two decades?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Two first teamers.
And I'm being specific here. AP All-American.
Yes, yes, yes. Do you feel as though the answer is relatively gettable given, you know, as someone who covers college basketball, or maybe like a little bit of a sneaky one?
You'll either get it, or when I tell you, you go, oh, yeah, of course.
All right, give me three guesses. My first one, this is a blind guess just because it's a recent team that had two good players. I don't think it's right, though. Did Decker and Kaminsky both be first-team All-Americans?
That is not it.
Okay. My second guess then is – I don't – okay. oh, Parrish. My second guess is there's just no. It's not. I'm not going to guess to that one. I'm not even going to put it out there. This is a great question, GP. No one from Nova. No one. Did Hansborough share it with anyone? UNC. Am I in the right church there? UNC.
I will tell you that if Hansborough did do it with somebody, and I don't know whether he did, it has happened more recently than when he was in college.
It has happened. Okay. So it wouldn't have been the Hansborough. I don't feel like Kansas would have had two guys share it. Parrish, like, you got.
Just tell me when you want.
I think you have me stumped here because I don't feel like any of the I feel like it was only Towns and it was only Anthony Davis. So I don't think either of the Kentucky ones did it. So you stumped me, and shouts to if any listeners got this as I've been mulling this in real time, particularly the fans of this team, they probably know it. But who is it?
You were on the right path. You were headed the right direction, but you gave up. 2010 Kentucky, John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins.
Gosh, I want to walk off this podcast right now. I'm so angry.
You named two Kentucky teams and didn't go to 2010. John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins. You know who else was the first team All-Americans, AP All-Americans?
Hold on. Let me guess. So that is 2010?
Yeah.
Was Jimmer good enough to be an All-American that year?
No. I mean, he might have been. He was not a first team AP All-American.
That would have been the year Duke won it. I feel like no one on Duke's team would have been good enough. No one on Butler would have been good enough. 2010, who else was good? That was not. No, that was 2010. I want to say that was because I'm trying to remember when it was before I got the CBS job. I think that might have been Evan Turner's year. Maybe Evan Turner was the year before, though.
is one of them.
What's up?
Evan Turner is one of them.
Sweet. So I need two more. Jeez. Gettable names or no?
They're gettable. Neither one went on to have any sort of good NBA career. Both played in what was – both played in the Big East.
2010 Big East. Oh, are we thinking – no way. We're not thinking the guy that went down in the Final Four for West Virginia, are we?
No. One – okay, I'll give you a hint. One was a transfer, transferred into a Big East program. Played, I believe, just 1 year there.
That helps me in no way. I'm not remembering a 2010 transfer, GP. Both in the Big East. I don't know. Give it up. Who is it?
Wes Johnson, Syracuse.
He was a first-team AP All-American?
First-team AP All-American. Teammates that year was Scoop Jardine and Brandon Trish and Chris Joseph and Andy Rottens and Mookie Jones. Okay. And then the other one was Scotty Reynolds at Villanova.
I should have gotten Scotty. Shame on me. Wes Johnson was an awesome college player. I just didn't realize he was that strong. And I believe transferred from Iowa State, if memory serves correct.
That is correct. So the last time two teammates were both first-team AP All-Americans, 2010 Kentucky, John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins. And you might remember this. It was that same year on January 26, 2010, that Kentucky team was undefeated. They were 19-0. They went to South Carolina. Devin Downey got 30 points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals, 68-62 upset of the Wildcats. He was an honorable mention AP All-American. Shouts to Devin Downey.
That's a disgrace, by the way. Honorable mention. Get out of my face with that.
Get out of my face. Get out of my freaking face with that honorable mention crap.
Any lingering thoughts from the Duke win, by the way, other than RJ Barrett was awesome and Alex O'Connell is only good when he plays Syracuse?
I know, right? And they burnt real quick on this. It's a little bit like people were putting it in my Twitter mentions. Do you have any issue with Mike Krzyzewski burning the red shirt?
For Baker, obviously?
Yeah.
No. And in fact, see, on – What was interesting is so we had like a preview show on CBS Sports HQ on Saturday. I was just talking for an hour about college basketball, so clearly we're going to preview the game. And I said, what's going to be fascinating about this is that Krzyzewski's had the time to plan for this without Zion Williamson. So we're going to see a certain dimension, I think, tonight from Duke that we just haven't seen all year by necessity because of what Zion does on both ends of the floor. Now, I didn't think that he would burn the red shirt. That was an unexpected move, and he wasn't a deciding factor in that or not. But it was a little interesting that he did that, given that we expect Williamson to return, frankly, maybe as soon as the Virginia Tech road game, but probably I think it's more likely maybe it's the one after that. Maybe they want to sit him after winning at Syracuse and seeing what they could do without him. So the question becomes, like, you burn the red shirt, and the assumption is you wouldn't have burned it if Williamson never got hurt, and yet he's not going to be out for a long time, so why do it? I don't have an issue with it because, frankly, the kid has to – like, you can't force him, like, to be like, we're going to burn this for you now. Like, I mean, you know, there was obviously a discussion that was had. But I feel like you're setting me up in that people made it a thing. If it was made into a thing, I missed that entirely.
Oh, it was made up into a thing by, I mean, North Carolina and Kentucky fans, right? Okay. You know, the type of fans who make everything about everything, make everything a thing. I would assume that you don't do that without talking to the kid first. You don't do that without talking to the parents first. And so I can't imagine there's a scenario where Mike Krzyzewski sat down with the parents and said, we're going to redshirt this freshman year and develop, and then we're going to get all these, you know, lottery picks out of here, and then your son will have a year of practice under his belt and still 4 years of eligibility. And then just yank the redshirt, you know, in the middle of February and play him 5 minutes. I just simply do not believe that's the way that went down. And so you got to assume that there was a conversation had and everybody was on the same page. And so if everybody's on the same page, why would I be upset about it?
Yeah, I'm with you there. We'll see how much playing time he gets going forward. We'll see if Williamson returns before we have our next podcast. Again, Duke plays at Virginia Tech on Tuesday night. I think Duke can win at Virginia Tech without him, because I'm not sure how much better Virginia Tech even is than Syracuse, because without Justin Robinson, like, it's an interesting dichotomy in that Zion Williamson gets hurt, and Duke, to its credit, has been fairly responsive and transparent about a lot that's happened there. Now, maybe some of that is by nature, the fact that it is Zion Williamson. And then Buzz Williams has been basically mum on Justin Robinson, the nature of the injury, how long he'll be out, whether he will return this season or not. And so you've got two different kinds of players and two different kinds of offenses that are going to be clashing there. And, you know, for sure Robinson's not going to be on the floor, barring something that we just are completely unaware of. And then Williamson, we wait and see on that. But that game does mean something. Like, this game helped Duke keep the number one overall seed standing, in my estimation. And now if it can get this one, like, it still holds there. Otherwise, the ACC race, I mean, it's a three-way tie atop the league right now. North Carolina looked good against Florida State over the weekend. Virginia trailed by double digits, then won by double digits against Louisville. Tony Bennett is, like, 9-1 all time against Louisville. That Cardinals fans cannot stand the sight of Tony Bennett at this point. But with all that we saw, GP, three-way tie atop the ACC, 12-2 apiece with those teams. And so the jockeying for really good seed standing as well is still in play, and that's why the Duke game on the road Tuesday night is just interesting and potentially has some consequences if Williamson does not play.
Can you imagine being 9-1 against Louisville and 0-1 against UMBC?
I know. There's really only one person who can't imagine that, because Tony Bennett is the only one, but yes.
Switching gears to the SEC, LSU beat Tennessee in overtime, even though Tremont Waters didn't play. Just an enormous win, and we'll get into what it means for LSU and its SEC title hopes in a moment. First, let me ask you this, because I was asked this earlier today on radio by our colleague Barrett Sally. Should the ref have called the foul on Grant Williams with less than a second left in OT and basically ended the game? I mean, that call ended the game.
Yes. Yes, have to call that. Now, it's a funky play. Like, Turner gets off the three. He's trying to beat the clock. It was on time and yet, like, a little bit rushed at the same time, if you feel me there. And then it's a weird bounce off that. Javonte Smart, who steps in for point guard in replace of Waters and has the game of his life, the freshman. He played well, you know. As fate would have it, it lands in his hands. He hits the sinking, the clinching shots, and no better guy to do it after the game he had, although Skylar Mays was also very, very, very good and played all 45 minutes in that one. But Grant Williams, you know, instinctively is going for the rebound. He bumps bodies. To me, Parrish, I don't even think it's controversial. You got to call the play in that moment, and it made for a really weird end of game for Williams, because the play before, he had a beautiful spin move to notch the game. I think that tied the game. Or no, I think it might have given Tennessee a two-point lead, and then LSU came down and tied it. And then Tennessee gets a decent look, like a perfectly thrown pass down to Williams, who has to take, like, it's kind of a tough fall away to the side from the right side that didn't fall in. But I had no issue with the call.
I'm with you. The alternative to calling the foul is not calling the foul. What happens if you don't call that? I mean, it's undeniably a foul. I mean, it's a collision. And, you're in Baton Rouge. You know, I know that calling the foul gets Rick Barnes furious and in your face. Not calling it has Will Wade probably running out there to fight you. I mean, plus like 15,000 LSU fans. You gotta make the call. It sucks, because if there is no foul there, we're going to double overtime, because no matter who gets that ball, if somebody gets it cleanly, nobody's scoring. You know, Devontae Smart's not throwing it 70 feet, and, you know, Grant Williams isn't putting up another shot with less than a second to go. Whoever grabs the ball, it's irrelevant, which, you know, I know Grant couldn't probably recognize this in real time, but, you know, if you could pause it and just say, okay, this overtime period is over, we're going to the next one, do not commit a foul. Obviously, that was the smart thing to do, but playing basketball in real time can be slightly more difficult than that. So it sucks, because it really did decide a game. It was on a play where neither player could have decided the game without a whistle. And so I get why you're frustrated at Tennessee if you're a Tennessee fan, but you should be frustrated with Grant Williams more than the referee. The referee did his job. Not to mention, if the referee doesn't make that call, and this is the thing that I think sometimes gets lost with the let the players decide the game crowd, swallow the whistle crowd. These guys all have bosses, and they're getting evaluated every minute of every game. And if you don't make that call, yeah, LSU fans might, LSU fans, I mean, Tennessee fans might be happy with you, but your bosses are going to be mad at you because you didn't do it correctly. So I don't blame the official at all. He did what he had to do.
He did. And I really like, I don't want to, we're going to be, I know we are destined to talk about officiating in March. It is going to happen. I don't want to, but it is an inevitability. So I don't want to spend really more than a minute on this, but you have to acknowledge, and for everyone that watched that game, just borderline unwatchable in how many times the officials had to go to the monitor and review a call, review the clock. Was it a block? Was it a charge? There was one where the guy was clearly in the circle and they still had to go and they reviewed it. Like, it was absurd. So
I would, I had just landed back home and I was driving home. So I was listening to the game on the radio. And so I was going to ask you about this because I didn't see it with my own eyes, but it the way the Tennessee play-by-play announcer described it, it was, he says, okay, they call a block,
yeah,
on a somebody, and then they go to the monitor to see if he's in the restricted zone. It doesn't matter if he was in the restricted zone. If you call it a block, it's a block. What does it matter if he's in the restricted zone or not?
Correct. I don't even know what the deal with that one was. Parrish, literally, they went to the monitor. I'm not exaggerating. Minimum five, maybe as many as seven times in the final, like, 3 minutes of regulation and then counting overtime as well. It totally ruined the flow of the game, and it was also part of why, like, Barnes has just had it. Like, your team loses a big game on the road, rowdy crowd, not a visually appealing or stimulating game at all, and then you get the call on Williams at the end. So, like, Barnes, who doesn't particularly run that hot, like he was and he had a right to, and in that moment, you're just like, you're so sick of it. Like, the game's over. Your team lost. You had to deal with all this bull crap, with all this stalling that happened. I hope that the director of SEC officiating and basically anyone that is a part of the officiating experience and adjudication of any sort of assignments or penalties or whatnot, anything, just that game was happening in kind of a standalone moment on Saturday afternoon, and let it be something to be wary of when we get to March. You can't have that. I mean, it is going to be – college basketball is going to get killed if we get an NCAA tournament game of any sort of note that goes through what we had there. You can improve the replay process, the review process. So that just – given what happened, we had to acknowledge that ending period. But for LSU, by the way, just a great win. The SEC, like the ACC, is now a three-team tie atop the league standings. Tennessee has now dropped its two most recent games, both against, by the way, the two best teams not named Tennessee in the SEC. I think a lot of teams, not all, but plenty of teams would have lost if they had to go play at Kentucky and then had to play at LSU. So they're all now 12-2 in the league. LSU is positioned well to finish atop the league standings now because its remaining games are A&M, Bama, Florida, Vanderbilt. Guess what? None of those teams are above 500 in SEC play. Meanwhile, Kentucky and Tennessee schedules are tougher than that, not to mention when you include the fact they have to play each other. So I think the eventual outcome here is, I think Kentucky's playing the best of any team in the SEC right now, but I think that Kentucky will lose at Tennessee, and what will happen is Tennessee and LSU will share the end of the regular season championship, and Kentucky will be one game behind, and then go watch this, and then watch Kentucky win the SEC tournament championship. And when that happens, if that all breaks out just the way that it did, you're going to have all three of those teams have a really, really strong shot at the two line or better. I think the floor for LSU at that point is a three, similar to Tennessee. So things are getting really interesting in a hurry. It's been a long time since the SEC had these three teams that were so strong at the top of the league, you know, viable Final Four contenders.
Tennessee is still safely on the two line, even though they've lost two of their past three games, because here's the truth. And you made this point, like, they're road games against legitimate top 20 teams. Like, good teams are going to lose those games. Like, getting blasted at Kentucky on a big stage was less than ideal. And obviously losing at LSU when there's no Tremont Waters there, you got to take advantage of that. I think, you know, Tennessee went from, you know, a projected underdog in that game to a projected favorite. It absolutely affected the point spread just before tip off. And so when you're ahead in that game for much of that game and the other team's best player's not there, you want to knock it out. But I mean, they still got three high level freshmen operating at LSU. But that was the weird thing. What if I told you Tremont Waters not going to play and Naz Reid not going to play well?
It's valid. Well,
how's LSU win? They won. Naz Reid didn't play well. I don't think he had a field goal. Tremont Waters didn't play. LSU still wins. And now I think we're going to have a shared SEC, regular season shared championship. But LSU is probably going to be a part of that. And they got a chance to maybe win it outright, depending on what happens going forward. Tennessee next up at Ole Miss. If you want to start asking questions about them, you can do it if they take another loss there. Even though Ole Miss has been in the top 25 at one point this season, and Kentucky, you know, Jerry Palm now has them on the one seed line. I will have them in the top four, which represents a one seed in Monday morning's top 25 and one. So John Calipari's got that thing undeniably headed in the right direction. They're playing really, really well right now. On Sunday afternoon, Michigan State was the biggest game of the day, and Michigan at home, where it was undefeated, playing a shorthanded Michigan State team and could not get it done. Michigan State goes and wins 77-70. And so just a massive win for Tom Izzo and that bunch. I'll be honest, I didn't give them much of a chance to go into Michigan and win, given you know that they're missing 40% of their best starting lineup. And yet they go in there, play well. And you mentioned Cassius Winston as a possible first-team All-American earlier. He had 27 points, 8 assists. He was 7 of 13 from the field, 13 of 14 from the free throw line. Just an awesome performance.
What a performance there by Winston. And I believe I had this one on the podcast, Parrish. I took Sparty to win on the road, took a little chance, got a little bit lucky. Very nice win for them in doing so. Take a step ahead in the Big Ten race and set up well because these two teams play each other in two of the final four games. And now the Wolverines will have to go. Big Blue will have to go and play at Michigan State to close out the regular season. We'll wait and see if they play each other in the Big Ten tournament thereafter. But Michigan State doing that the way that it did, I think, you know, if you want a reason why it's able to do this kind of thing and play that well and score, you know, 77 on Michigan, a very impressive performance. No Langford, no Nick Ward. I think a lot of the way that Tom Izzo has built this offense, and Cassius Winston has just developed into such a great college player, is a significant reason for that. Very impressive. Now, I have to be completely transparent here, though. So as the crossover of Twitter followers and podcast listeners will know, I went to the Cincinnati-UConn game in Hartford on Sunday, which wound up being actually a relatively decent game. I said hello to your bud, Khalid El Amin. I said hello to our CBS Sports HQ colleague, Rip Hamilton, both of them on the 1999 championship squad for UConn. They were honored along with Jim Calhoun and almost the entire team there on hand in Hartford. So I caught that game. Cincinnati won. That's a good underrated team, but I was making my way back home, so I missed most of this game. So I didn't see like the first half play out with these teams whatsoever, but it is a great sign. Bottom line it this way. Michigan is still operated like an elite defense. Michigan State goes into their building without two of their four most important players and drops 77 and wins with a little bit of elbow room. That's a great sign for Michigan State, which seems to have shaken off that three-game losing streak that had endured about a month ago, and now it's really rolling. Final games at Indiana, that's a win. Home Nebraska, that's a win. Home Michigan, probably a win. If doing so, it would finish out at, 17-3 in Big Ten play? Yeah, they're at 20 league games right now. And Sparty would definitely have a chance at a one seed there. Probably be sitting pretty well considering the fact that the numbers are going to bake in to help them. This rates as the best conference in America. And so the number of quad one and quad two opportunities will help them as well, which leads me to this. You can say whatever you want about Sparty and Michigan, but Parrish, I noticed you have recently switched in your top 25 and one from defining teams and accomplishments by their KenPom top 100 wins to quad one and quad two. I'm curious as to what the impetus for that was.
Honestly, I found a website that sorts all the data automatically, and it's just so much easier to look at.
Okay.
I mean, that really is it. Are you familiar with this website?
If you're referring to Warren Nolan, yes, I am.
Yeah, warrennolan.com.
JP, just behind the trends, man. This has been a thing for like 5-6 years.
No. I'm aware of Warren Nolan. I just didn't know it was sorting the net rankings the way it was sorting the net rankings until we were in studio last week, and I was walking by somebody else's computer, like one of the research guys, and I was like, whoa, they got all of the net ranking stuff sorted right there, updated like every day. He was like, yeah. I was like, Jesus Christ, I cannot believe I've been counting KenPom wins 1, 2, 3 with my finger on my computer screen all season long when this is sorted for you. And really what you find out is it doesn't, and I think this is sort of interesting, it really didn't make me change my opinion on where I should have teams that much. It's the information presented differently, but the conclusions you're going to reach are very similar.
The idea of you, as I know your daily schedule, because we're essentially married at this point, waking up and at like 5:15 in the morning, like, you're like 8 inches from your screen squinting, and you're like, you're literally, the index finger is making contact with the screen as you're counting on the KenPom slate, like one, two. Yes. Wait, am I at 6 or am I at 7? Oh, damn it, I got to start over here. That's my life.
And so I really did it, and today was the first day that I did it because I wanted it to be consistent. I didn't want some teams' comments to have KenPom data and the other ones to have quadrant one, quadrant two data. So I decided I would commit to it on a day where I had to make a bunch of changes anyway, and then I just make changes on every team. And it's the information presented in a different way, but the conclusions reached are pretty similar to what they otherwise would be.
Well, I was going to say that was just coincidental that I ended up checking today because I checked for one very specific reason, because I try not to look at your rankings too often because, frankly, I don't want them to influence my Thursday power rankings. But I was like, you know what? I got to check these things out right now because Wofford got to 24 and freaking 4, and they got to be ranked. And shouts to Parrish putting the Terriers in. I mean, they're in 26, 22, 21 would be, that would be understandable. But regardless, you finally have put in those Terriers who continue to climb up every metric, every ranking. They get a great road win against Furman. And note, like, all seriousness, if that team wins out, I think it will have a shot at a 6 seed. If you look at all of that it's going to have compiled and its lack of bad losses, which is, frankly, an incredible achievement. It's not like Nevada where they had a stacked roster coming back, had made the Sweet 16 and done all this, and they have future pros. Like, they might have one Fletcher McGee. What Wofford's doing is, in all seriousness, awesome, and I'm just happy that you ranked them.
They deserve to be there. I think I dropped Iowa State out, and so I had a spot open up, and I was picking between Wofford and Washington. And when I looked at the resumes, I concluded that Wofford deserved to be in over Washington. But good news, Washington fans, because today Villanova lost, got blasted, got beat pretty good at Xavier. I'm dropping Villanova from the top 25 on one Monday morning. Wofford goes up to 25. Washington will be the new number 26.
Love it. Cool. Anything else to add to you?
Because every morning for a while, I tweet a link to the top 25 and one. And I want to be clear about this because I think sometimes I speak in absolutes or people speak in absolutes, and I don't want to do that because it's not fair. Not all Kentucky fans are crazy. I don't even think most Kentucky fans are crazy. But there are some crazy Kentucky fans, and they would tweet me every morning. How could you possibly have Michigan over Kentucky? Parrish, you're an idiot. Parrish, you're biased. Parrish, you don't watch the game. All this stuff you hear, right? And I was almost today. I was going to tweet in response, because I got the question five times immediately, and I was going to tweet the response. Here's the explanation for Michigan over Kentucky, because there's a lot of reasons to have Michigan over Kentucky as of this morning. And if you want to have Kentucky over Michigan, that's fine. You can make that case too, but there's a lot of stuff there that suggests Michigan can reasonably be ranked ahead of Kentucky, and I was going to tweet the explanation, and I stopped myself again, and I said, the second I do this, Michigan's going to lose at home to Michigan State. And I'm going to have to listen to it more so than I would even otherwise have to listen to it. So I hit delete on that tweet, and thank God, because then Michigan loses at home to Michigan State. And Monday morning, yes, Kentucky will be ahead of Michigan. Kentucky will be in the top four. But any of Kentucky fans who had tweeted me about this, understand as of Sunday morning, everything I'm about to tell you was true. Michigan had 11 wins against top 50 KenPom teams. Kentucky had 9. Michigan had fewer losses. Michigan had no losses to sub 50 KenPom teams. Kentucky still has 2. Michigan was undefeated at home. Kentucky's got a home loss. Again, if you want to have Kentucky over Michigan, you can. But I mean, all of that stuff, it makes it where it's not crazy to have Michigan over Kentucky as of Sunday morning. As of Monday morning, it might be a little crazy because they just lost at home to a shorthanded Michigan State team, and I will adjust appropriately. But I just wanted to make sure if the Kentucky fans like sincerely had questions why Michigan over Kentucky as of Sunday morning, that would be the answer. Oh, also, as of Sunday morning, Michigan was 15-4. In quadrant 1/quadrant 2 opportunities, Kentucky was 14-4 in quadrant 1/quadrant 2 opportunities. Not a big difference, but a difference. So that's the rationale between the rationale for Michigan above Kentucky as of Sunday morning. But on Monday morning, it will not look the same. Before we get out of here, real quick, I wanted to acknowledge what happened in Oxford on Saturday with some pro-Confederacy groups organizing a march onto the Ole Miss campus. Eight Ole Miss basketball players took a knee during the national anthem to peacefully protest the hate groups. It started with one player, then five more quickly joined him, then two more knelt near the end of the Star Spangled Banner. And then afterward, Ole Miss guard Brian Tyree, who could easily be a Game of Thrones character, was asked about it. And here's what he said. He said, quote, "We saw one of our teammates doing it, and we just didn't want him to be alone. We're just tired of these hate groups coming to our school and portraying our campus like it's our actual university having these hate groups at our school." Then he later tweeted, "To the people that fight for this country," because predictably there was some backlash, particularly in Mississippi, "to the people that fight for this country, my teammates and I meant no disrespect to everything you do for us, but we had to take a stand to the negative things that went on today on our campus. Hashtag we need change." Norlander, since Colin Kaepernick started his protest during the anthem in 2016, no high major men's basketball players had taken a knee during the anthem, not anywhere in this country. And I'll tell you, as a Mississippian, I did not think my home state would be where it first happened, but it happened in Mississippi on Saturday. What'd you make of the Ole Miss players, what they did?
Yeah, when this started circulating, it took me back, and I guess in a good way, in that I was like, wow, this is happening at Ole Miss. Like, think about the history. And for those that might be listening to the podcast that aren't familiar with it, go ahead and research and look up that school and what it meant to integrate universities in the South and in Mississippi and Alabama in the 1950s and 1960s. The gravity of that wasn't lost on me at all. And you can and should speak much more to this, as this is your home state. It came also with a bit of an awkward coincidence, in that Kermit Davis, the coach, when he got the job last year, had specifically mentioned that his team would honor and respect the national anthem and or the flag. I don't want to misquote him entirely, but he mentioned along those lines the importance of that. But I have zero issue with them doing this, particularly when you look at, you know, all of the toxicity that exists with racism and things that are connected to the Confederate flag, and how those things can really just create schisms in communities that, frankly, have no business even existing in this world, in the United States of America in 2019, let alone when so much of this was taking place. So credit to Tyree and the rest of his teammates for doing that and for making a statement. It seems like it is going to be a one game kind of thing. Who knows? I thought Davis and the athletic director, Parrish, I saw what you shared late on Saturday night. Ross Bjork, the Ole Miss AD, also passed along his thoughts and, you know, his response to what his players did there. But certainly, you know, just it strikes a powerful image, and the reasons they did it were, frankly, logical, if not not one of pride and wanting to say, you know, this kind of hate and these kinds of clashes that stem from such evil places have no place on our campus, in our community, and as we try and, you know, foster the kind of community experience where we can live with each other and respect differences, respect being the key word. I thought it was a very grown-up thing to do, and for anyone that might have an issue with it, I think you really need to take a second to pause and just consider what those men and frankly their families and friends going back, you know, generations have gone through. Pretty awesome response by the Ole Miss players there, I thought.
I was proud of the players for doing what they did. And as a Mississippian, you know, I don't just speak as a college basketball columnist on this subject. I speak as a Mississippian, as the husband of an Ole Miss graduate. And I was proud of the players for what they did. I was proud of Kermit and Ross for how they handled it. And I told them both that showing support for their players, A, it was the smart thing to do, if only because the alternative is going to get you killed.
Yes.
From a negative recruiting. Ole Miss already has to deal with negative recruiting about Ole Miss's very complicated, somewhat entirely embarrassing past. There's been some ugly, nasty stuff that's happened on that campus. So they already get hit with that. It's why they got rid of Colonel Reb. It's why they banned the Confederate flag. They've tried to strip away all of this stuff. And I'll just be honest with you, within the state, it's not a completely popular thing to do. There are still people, you know, screaming, bring back Colonel Reb. So Ole Miss already gets hit with this. If you're a coach and AD, if you don't stand behind your players, it's going to get even worse on the recruiting trail when you are recruiting largely African-American student athletes. So it was the smart thing to do, but it was also the right thing to do. And so I was proud of them for handling it the way they did. To Brian's point, he's exactly right. What happens is these hate groups, sometimes they aren't even from the state of Mississippi, the people involved, but they show up in Oxford, Mississippi. They march on the Ole Miss campus, and then it's like the KKK is on campus at Ole Miss. We have a producer at CBSSports.com, and one of her stories about being at Ole Miss, you know, because she traveled to SEC games for the big Saturday games. Her memory of being at Ole Miss is she was there the same time the KKK was there. That's when you say Ole Miss, that's what she thinks about. And they sort of they show up and then they co-opt the campus, and it becomes a KKK is at Ole Miss. Ole Miss is racist. And Brian Tyree's point is these people got nothing to do with our campus. That they walked on our campus. They're not even from here. That they walked on our campus doesn't mean that represents our campus. That's not who we are, and we're tired of it being portrayed that way. And so I you know, obviously he was going to get asked about it because he's the leader afterward, and he did take a knee. I thought he handled it as well as any college student could. And for the people who still don't get it for whatever reason, let me just say two things. One, stop calling it an anthem protest. It's not an anthem protest. It's a protest during the anthem. I had to get on this page a long time ago, as much as I talked about this subject on radio, talking about this subject on radio in the South. It is not an anthem protest. That's what your redneck uncle calls it. Yeah, they're protesting the anthem. They're protesting the flag. It's not an anthem protest. It's a protest during the anthem. Nobody's protesting the anthem. Nobody is protesting the flag. People are, in this case, protesting. The Ole Miss players were protesting a hate group that marched onto campus. In Colin Kaepernick's situation, protesting racial inequality and police brutality. But it's not an anthem protest, and it's not a flag protest. If you keep calling it that, you're being dumb, either because you're dumb or you're intentionally being dumb because you want to make the points you want to make. Secondly, I got this question a lot last night and even into today. Well, I just don't see why they have to do it during the national anthem. You don't? Because that is where it has proven to be effective. You know, Brian Tyree, he could protest on his own time. You wouldn't know if he did it on his own time. It became the biggest story in college basketball yesterday. I mean, it was trending. It was on every highlight show. It was on actual newscast. Not sportscast, newscast, because they did it during the anthem. That is the point, to peacefully protest in a way that makes people pay attention, that makes people ask questions, that gives you an opportunity to answer those questions, that makes people focus on the topic you want them to focus to. People, if Brian Tyree just went and protested at the Starbucks down the street from the hate group, nobody would know, nobody would care. Take a knee in the national anthem right before an SEC basketball game? Okay. Now got the cameras on you. Now people are noticing. Now you're getting to have the conversation that you want to have. It worked incredibly for Colin Kaepernick because we've been having these conversations for nearly 3 years now, and it worked incredibly for the Ole Miss basketball team yesterday. And that's the answer to why do it during the anthem, because that's where it's most effective.
All right, and that's a great way to wrap this edition of the pod. We'll be back later in the week to see what we got from Monday and Tuesday. We won't be short on news, some interesting results as well, and the hump day ones are always fun and curious in their own regard. So whether we record Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, you know you'll have it right waiting for you. We won't let you down.
Once again, shouts to Devin Downey, shouts to Chester, South Carolina, shouts to Terry M.F. Pentigo, he's the legend, shouts to Larnell, and thank you if you have already subscribed to the Island College Basketball Podcast. I notice when you do. I read your comments. You guys have been excellent about that. It really means a lot. I appreciate you doing it. If you haven't done it yet, please go do that. Subscribe for our purposes, sure, but it also is the best way to ensure you get the latest episodes as quickly as possible. So go do that. It takes less than a minute. While you're doing that, rate it favorably, 5 stars, leave a nice comment. If you do that, I'll owe you forever. And either way, we will talk to you again late Tuesday, early Wednesday. Till then, take care.